Hello and welcome to Crosstalk, where all things are considered. I'm Peter Lavelle. The conflict in Ukraine soon will enter its third year. During this time, much has happened and many predictions made. Western rhetoric has also changed a lot. From Russia is losing to Ukraine has already won, and to Biden's as long as we can. Rhetoric doesn't change the reality on the ground. Crosstalking Ukraine, I'm joined by my guest, Lawrence Wilkerson in Falls Church. He is the former chief of staff to the chairman of the U.S. Joint Chiefs of Staff. And in Marseille, we cross to Freddy Ponton. He is an independent journalist and a contributor at 21stCenturyWire.com. All right, gentlemen, crosstalk rules in effect. That means you can jump anytime you want, and I always appreciate it. Larry, if I can go to you first here as we go into the new year and the third year of this conflict here. I think it's fair to say, and I'm a pretty skeptical person, I've watched a lot of your commentary, you're very skeptical as well, but a glimmer, a sliver of realism is beginning to come into the conversation. Unfortunately, it centers around finance and funding this war, proxy war in Ukraine. But at the same time, there's still a lot of magical thinking. What are your thoughts as the new year starts?
I think the funding issue is more a congressional problem than it is a statement on whether or not the U.S. still supports Ukraine, although I do detect a tendency of a fall off there. And I would say that there are as many Republicans as Democrats who, frankly, detest Russia for what reasons I'm unable to fathom, but they do. And so I wouldn't discount the possibility of the money eventually coming through. That said, you're right about the fall off. I think Biden's administration realizes that this is a losing proposition, but his focus now is entirely on winning the presidency again in 2024. And he is going to be judged. That's his calculus now, strategic and otherwise. He's going to be judging every action on that. And I think what they've decided, at least tentatively, is Zelensky has lost, but Ukraine has won. And how do you present that? And how do you take that to negotiations?
Well, you're right. I'm actually been more fascinated with how they've spun this conflict, the rhetoric behind it. Freddie, it's very interesting is that we had the last major shift was from as long as it takes is as long as we can. And that tells you a whole lot. And essentially, there's a sense here that the Biden administration is saying, well, we did what we could do. Now this is a hot potato and they're throwing it to Congress.
Well, absolutely. I think this is a situation that's really begging for more question as we speak. And we're seeing this this scenario unfolding, which doesn't make any sense. And as my colleague just said, you know, it doesn't make a lot of sense at this moment, because the amount of money that has been thrown not only towards Israel, but also towards Ukraine is starting to literally break in the bank. And it's breaking the bank, which means that Volodymyr Zelensky is now and has by now realized that he's no longer in the front of the queue and he basically has to wait in line. And I think for me, what's really the most striking is the, of course, the new Speaker House, Mike Johnson, undying loyalty to Israel. It's become very clear to me that Kiev regime is no longer a priority for the House Republicans. And we have to draw lessons as well from previous speakers, McCarthy as well, which was a big supporter of Ukraine war effort, which is probably part of the reason why he was likely ousted in the first place. But for those that have played attention, Peter, we can see that in 2024, many war hawks, you know, and doesn't matter on which bench they are sitting, they will be getting more money, which is rather ironic since the leadership change was about reducing the overseas war spending in the first instance. So there's a lot of things that really don't make any sense at the moment on what we are seeing. And I think it's really going to affect the bottom line and the outcome of this conflict,
Peter. Well, I'm not really sure. sure. Larry, let me go back to you. I mean, you know, the only thing that Congress actually really does when you think about it is spend money or maybe waste money. I think it's, you know, what are we getting for this money here? Because Russia should have been bankrupt by now. Crimea should be back in Ukrainian hands. I mean, I could go on and on. I mean, it's trying to, you know, sell a bill of goods. So what are we actually getting for it? I mean, we'll spend the money, but, you know, where's the victory parade? And I think that's one of the problems that there. It's a problem of selling it also. Larry.
Absolutely true. And I will say that the American people have not been present in this debate, really, not significantly. And there are reasons for that. But I sense that they are increasingly worried about what's happening, particularly in Gaza. Yeah. And just to show how Gaza impacted Ukraine, just look at the 155 artillery rounds. We were sending hundreds of them, thousands of them, to Ukraine from our war reserve stocks in Israel. That got stopped really quickly. So this new conflict in Gaza is not only peeling people away from Biden, it's impacting the entire country in terms of, and I didn't think in my lifetime I would see this, in terms of the American people's support for Israel. It is falling off dramatically, even amongst Jewish Americans.
Particularly among a lot of Jewish Americans. I can't tell you both how many of regular guests on this program who happen to be Jewish from America and Europe clamoring, you know, filling up my inbox. They want to talk about this because they're so infuriating. And of course, this is something I talk about every week, but let's stay with Ukraine here. Freddie, I mean, one of the things that's very interesting is that we all know, since Larry's brought up Gaza, we know that all around the world, and particularly in the Western world, you see these protests against the war in Gaza. Where are all the protests for Ukraine? I miss them, I seem to think, because this was an elite project from the very, very beginning. Most people didn't know where Ukraine was. They probably still don't, okay? But this was an elite agenda that is really not going anywhere. I mean, the elite's going to stick with it. I'm sure of that. But never caught on the public imagination.
Well, it's a very good point here, Peter, because obviously, I mean, in France and in Central Europe, mainly you've seen the lack of interest for this Ukrainian-Russian conflict has diminished tremendously. I think everybody's going back to their priority domestically. We can see the U.S. doing that as well, you know, where the political agenda and even towards the preparation of the presidential election in 2024, I think people are refocusing on what's important. Focusing on, obviously, the border for the United States in Europe, trying to basically tackle the very, very sudden inflation, which has crippled the businesses all across the European member states. And then, of course, we have this problem of immigration, which is a false problem that is wrongly addressed, very poor communications, and a terrible agenda that is unfolding on the European member state for the past 2 years. So the crisis of Ukraine appears as something that is just on the side walk, if you will, because we just have too much problem of our own. And it's getting very, very difficult for our government to sell the idea of, you know, sending more money to Ukraine. I think if our governments, whether it's U.S., whether it's the European members that were more reasonable for the U.S., they will probably take 20% of that money sent to Ukraine and trying to finish the Trump's wall, for example, at the border. And then for Europe, it will be the same. We have still a lot of people that sleep in the car, people that have actually need for help and support with the winter comings. I mean, these are the people we need to support. How can we help others when we can't even help ourselves? And that's, I think, the reason why we're right now losing interest in supporting Ukraine.
You know, but it's also interesting, Larry, is that the thrust of this policy in Ukraine was always to punish Russia. And if they're not getting that in return, as a matter of fact, the Russian economy is back on track. It's growing territory. The ruble is fine. Trade is fine. I mean, none of the things that they had predicted. So, I mean, what's the, you know, bang for the buck? I mean, how much more do you want to spend on getting zero results?
Well, the bang for the buck for Lockheed Martin and Raytheon and a host of
others.
Well,
yeah, of course, merchants. Of course.
It was quite lucrative. You had shareholder meetings where CEOs are saying to the shareholders, business is good, business is really fine. In that sense, you're right. The elites in America, the billionaires, made some money off this war. But you're also right that, and my colleague there is right in saying that people are tiring of the wastage. We're looking at billions of dollars having been wasted. And in this country, we're looking at a $34, $35, $36 trillion aggregate debt, and next year, $1 trillion interest payments on that debt, and federal discretionary spending probably nothing but entitlements in the defense budget. There will be no money left over. So this is getting to be a real problem for this empire, trying to keep its finances in order, because it's been so flagrantly irresponsible with the wars over the last 20-plus years. Wars, incidentally, that none of which it has won.
Yeah.
It's a disaster for the
empire. Well, there's no downside in failing, is there, Larry? There's no downside.
No downside whatsoever. We take generals who fail 8, 9, 10 times in a row in Afghanistan, for example, and make them chiefs of service or send them to Lockheed for seven-figure salaries.
You probably know this number. I mean, how many generals were there in the Second World War as opposed to the number of generals today?
It's about 8-to-1 difference. The more alarming figure.
Please be very specific for my viewers. 8-to-1. In what direction?
Well, we're talking about more generals per troops now than in World War II, when we had 12 million men under arms. but more worrisome than that is, in the last 5 years, of the 4-star generals retiring, 80% of them went to work in the defense complex.
Well, I guess that's why you go. Well, it's kind of very much like akin to a politician's today, particularly in Europe. You become prime minister just to go work for Tony Blair later or Bill Gates, okay? It seems that public service is not the highest calling for these people at whatsoever.
Actually, I was testifying before Elizabeth Warren's committee in the Senate recently, and the ranking majority member from Florida, Rick Scott, essentially said, why shouldn't these guys go out and get to make some money? when it was pointed out, she was holding the hearing based on the ethics in the Defense Department. And this is the ranking minority member, Republican Rick Scott from Florida, saying, well, so what? They should be able to go out there
and Larry, before we go to the break here, that's why they love Nikki Haley. She understands how the game works, and she's very good at it. All right, gentlemen, I'm going to jump in here. We're going to go to a short break. And after that short break, we'll continue our discussion on Ukraine. Stay with RT. Welcome back to Crosstalk, where all things are considered. I'm Peter LaVelle. To remind you, we're discussing Ukraine. Okay, also part of our conversation, in Belgrade, we have Stephen Gajic. He is a research associate at Belgrade's Institute of European Studies. Welcome to the program here. Better late than never. I've been talking with Larry and Freddie about how the Ukraine project is progressing in this new year. One of the things that's very interesting also when we look at it is that, and I'm focused very much on how it's pitched to the public, well, I wouldn't be surprised this year they're going to say, well, Ukraine has already won, okay? So the Russians have been defeated. They didn't take 80—they left 80% of Ukraine unoccupied. So they're a winner, okay? I can see that, and it's already—if you look at some of the think tanks, they're already trying to sell this to the public. Go ahead.
I think they are, and in a way, they might be right, because from the standpoint of Washington, this was a premeditated war crime, because what they see is parts of ex-Soviet Union fighting each other. So the big secret is that actually most of Ukrainians are Russian, and in a sense, this is a Russian against Russian civil war. So that is why Washington is just fueling the fire by giving the old and some of the new weapons so that their old enemy can tire itself in this war. However, I think that this won't work because Russia is not going to bite the bait and it won't accept the so-called Korean scenario.
Right.
What I think is the second best option, apart from Russia falling apart and the multinational corporations taking all the loot, is for this frozen conflict to last for the next couple of decades, so that you have this anti-Russia basically sitting next to Russia and preparing for the next war.
We've heard this. It's like a comic strip, isn't it? Okay, because all of these things that we hear. I'm going to go to Larry right now. All these little theories that we come out. Russia is absent from the decision-making process. They're the object. They're always focusing. They don't have any say. Larry. Another one of the trends that we've seen is the Ukrainianization of the process. They'll build their own arms right now. This is an echo of how the U.S. tried to get out of Indochina. Leave it to the locals here. Though it didn't work out, obviously, and it won't work out this time. But this is another discursive change they're trying to push. Larry.
I don't question that rationale or reasoning. I do question Putin's decision to invade when he did, though, because I think it was quite clear, partly because of Russia's establishing some sort of obedience, if you will, within Germany with regard to energy. I think it was quite clear NATO's days were numbered. And what Putin did by invading, I understand why he did, and I understand his motivation. I don't necessarily accept the fact that he had to invade, but I understand it. NATO was going. It wouldn't have lasted another decade, in my view. He solidified it pretty significantly by the invasion. I think it's still going, but it'll take longer now, and it'll fall apart around the edges before it falls out of the center. And Germany will be that center that takes it apart. So I don't buy the idea that the conflict can continue without some real repercussions. It needs to stop, not least reason of which is the same reason Gaza needs to stop: all the killing,
all the
distraction from other problems we have, not least of which is no nuclear weapons treaty regime whatsoever anymore. And a lot of aspirant states again thinking about getting nuclear weapons. This is not a good development.
Larry's rationale is very interesting here. I've thought about it too, about the trajectory of NATO. And this conflict is actually giving it a shot in the arm. I understand that. But losing against Russia is also going to be very, very painful. And it's going to be hard to reconcile continuing it. Go ahead.
Well, it's going to be terribly difficult for any sides anyway. There's no winner in that sense. But I think for me, the elephant in the room when we talk about changing the narrative is what the U.S. used to say and what they are currently saying. I mean, we started with as long as it takes, and we end up this conflict with literally as long as they can. So clearly, there's a problem here. So establishing a narrative of victory based on numbers which we have, which have upward of 400,000 Ukrainian death in this conflict. I mean, we're not talking about small numbers, and these are figures, in my views, that are impossible to sell. They are very difficult to sell as a victory. And the U.S., I think, and the European taxpayers are very sensitive to that. And of course, if you add to that the loss of territories and the debacle of the Ukrainian counteroffenses, all you've left with to sell is a victory with the promise of what tomorrow might be made of. Nothing is really concrete. And it, for us as French people, for example, it reminds us a little bit of Napoleon, who was, always claiming a great victory, but losing half of his army. So you can't sell that in Europe. I'm not too sure about the United States, how it's perceived within the public realm. But in France, people are not buying it. So building a narrative on that is going to be extremely, extremely difficult. And I think also we can all perceive, and also the public is perceiving, perceiving that the Biden administration is on tremendous pressure after the debacle of the Afghanistan retreat. And that really is playing an important role today, because on the PR scene, and it's the message that is going to be constructed around basically this defeat has to be some form of victory. It doesn't have to make sense. It just has to be constructed that way.
Well, yeah, I mean, the Russians didn't make it to Paris. So Ukraine won. I mean, it'll be something silly like that. Okay, Stephen, yeah. But you know, Ukraine is also under an enormous amount of strain. I mean, obviously, its young men don't want to fight, obviously because of the meat grinder. But we have a collapse of the economy as well. I mean, and even civil society and order are at stake here. And very few people actually talk about that. Go ahead, Stephen.
Exactly. I mean, the estimate is that around 30,000 people legally leave the country for good every month. And God knows how many men are trying to...
But Stephen, you brought up a really good point. They're leaving for good. They're not, and the people that have left are probably not going to come back. Keep going.
Exactly. And another thing is that now Ukrainian Ministry of Defense is buying 50,000 women's infantry gear, which says a lot. And it seems to me that they really don't respect life and are ready to spend every person, I can't even say man anymore, because now they're mobilizing everybody, including people with disabilities, which we've seen in the past, to fight and to prolong this for a day or two. However, I think that at some point there will be a complete collapse, a complete societal collapse, and eventually capitulation. And I think that's the only way out of this conflict, because otherwise it just won't end.
Well, you know, Larry, Stephen just brought up the 50,000 uniforms for women. And that tells you one thing, but it tells me something. I wonder how much each uniform cost, okay? Well, you know, are they $5,000 per? I mean, this whole grift is infuriating, because that's how I have essentially looked at it. For people in the West, powerful people, it's a grift, and they're destroying a society in the process. Larry, go ahead and Falls Church.
No, that's a huge component of it. But we're dealing in the weeds now. They're important weeds, perhaps, and there's a lot of blood in those weeds. But we're looking at a situation in this country right now where if we stay on the current course with regard to our situation in Gaza and the Levant in general, we probably are going to be inviting a regional war. And the Red Sea is just a tiny little part of that right now. But I participated in a war game series about 5 years ago at all places, the U.S. Institute of Peace, where we brought in everyone, yep. The EU, Britain, Germany, all the people in the world who were interested in the Red Sea. And there was a lot of shock in that room. Even Mercy Corps was there, because they were in with the Houthis the Houthi conflict. That is the new cockpit of strategic competition now, and we're seeing that. Persian Gulf, you look at the commerce that flows through the Red Sea. So there are a lot of things percolating right now, particularly for the empire, the American empire.
Well, Larry, I don't know if you noticed that John Kirby and his many media appearances, I found it really quite curious when he was talking about getting that flotilla together.
What an idiot he is.
Well, he is an idiot, let me finish, because I think you'll agree with me. He said, but this time we really, really have an interest here. We actually have he gave it away. He said that Ukraine, no, we don't, okay. We have no interest in watching a genocide. But in trade, what we really do care about that. I thought it was such a giveaway, Larry.
Yes, 60% of the world's commerce flows through there. And diverting it the way they're having to do to a certain extent right now can get very, very expensive and raise prices all across the world. We did a simulation exercise with petroleum in Beijing in 2009, and the Chinese were utterly shocked when we showed them what would happen if we disturb things like insurance, ship builders and ships owners wanting to ply the seas. And so this is a very disruptive situation. And Kirby's right, at least, that this is serious stuff. whereas the other things are serious in terms of the blood that's flowing, but not necessarily serious in terms of the real security interests of the United States. And John Mearsheimer's right, too, when he says we're focusing on Ukraine and to a certain extent on Gaza, when the real threat, if there is a genuine threat in the world, state threat to the United States, is in China. And what has the Ukraine war done but make Moscow and China almost in a tacit alliance? So we have made a lot of errors in the past 20 years.
All right, Freddie, I'm going to give the last word to you. Are we going to 40 seconds? Or what are we going to see? How is Ukraine going to end this calendar year, Freddie?
Well, I think it's, for me, it's very clear that Ukraine decision to end this conflict will come from the United States, not from Ukraine. Ukraine has never decided anything in this conflict, and NATO and the U.S. will come up with a story to tell. But what's very important, Peter, is there is a clock attached to that. More time is spending, less territories, and less weight they're going to have within these negotiations. And I think that's really the takeaway, is to understand that the time is of the essence, because Russia is in no rush.
Russia, you know, that is a very key point. That
Russia
is a very
is
key
in,
point.
And I'm, and that's exactly where we're going to end this program here. I want to thank my guests in Falls Church, Belgrade, and in Marseille. And of course, I want to thank our viewers for watching us here at RT. See you next time. And remember, Crosstalk Rules.